Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, listeners. This is Luke recording this in my flat in Paris, as usual. It's a Monday lunchtime. And this episode of Luke's English Podcast is all about the terrorist attacks which happened here last Friday evening. I'm joined by Paul Taylor. Hello, Paul.
Hi.
And we're just going to talk about what happened and what's going on and all that kind of thing. All right. So actually, first of all, before we go into this, I should say thank you very much for your concern. As you know, I live in Paris, and I should say right now, thank you very much for all the messages that I've had from Lepsters. Lots of people contacted me in various ways, including loads of messages on my website, saying that they were concerned about my safety and the safety of my family and friends. Thankfully, I can say that I'm fine, and so is everyone I know, including my wife, her family, and all our friends, including Amber and Paul, of course. Paul is here, and he's. I mean, you look all right, Paul.
I'm doing all right. I actually don't know if it's sunk in. To be honest, I think I should be more worried. But
yeah, well, it's difficult to know how to sort of respond to this kind of thing. Obviously, it's a horrible shock, and terrible events have happened. But at the same time, you kind of think, well, we shouldn't let it stop us from being normal.
Yeah,
because then those twats win, don't they?
Well, exactly. Yeah, but I feel like I should go through a period of like, oh, this is real, but yeah. That hasn't happened yet, which is...
What would that mean, though, for you? How would you know if you were going through a period of this is real?
I don't know, just having I don't know. Yeah, just like having a weird feeling in my stomach, which I haven't really had yet. I've had a couple of times when I've had like 5 seconds to think about what's happened.
Yeah,
but as I guess we'll talk about, I haven't had a lot of time.
It's difficult for the reality to set in when something so out of the ordinary happens. It's difficult to know. I mean, it's obviously shocking and upsetting, but it's hard to know how to react. We're everyone's fine, everyone's okay. Obviously, we're a bit sort of shocked and stunned by what's gone on this weekend. Of course, our thoughts go out to those people who have been directly affected by the attacks, the victims and their families. It's very sad, it's shocking, and it's infuriating. But one thing's for sure, we have to carry on as normal to make sure that these terrorists don't win. And so life goes on today on this Monday. Lots of people have gone back to work. I went back to work today, but I arrived at school and there was no one there. And I thought, what's going on? Has everyone decided to just stay in bed? And of course, I'm the only one who doesn't know that they cancelled the classes.
They didn't call you. They didn't send you a message.
To be honest, I think that they probably sent an email out, but I didn't check my emails. And so, I didn't notice. So no one else was there. Everyone else was in bed. And I was, getting up in the morning, like going down to work, and I arrived and I was getting my lessons ready and everything. And one of the members of staff was like, there are no classes today, right? Mm. And I was like, what? No classes?
I bet you the kids are loving it today. Like, because kids don't know what's happening, right? But all they know is that they don't have school today.
Right.
And they love it. I guarantee it. I remember the day after 9/11.
Yeah, 9/12. I suppose that would be.
Yeah, 9/12. Yeah. So the 12th of September.
Right.
How old was I? 14. We didn't have school the next day. I was loving it. I didn't understand what was happening. Yeah. I was just seeing. I mean, yeah, 14, you're old enough, but you're not really old enough. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Mm. You're just seeing towers getting hit by planes and you think, okay, that's pretty bad. But
also, another weird thing is that I suppose lots of people out there listening to this have seen the coverage on the news and they've kind of, found out all about it by watching the news and stuff. And in fact, it's not completely realistic what you see in the news, because the news focuses only on certain things.
Yeah.
And to be honest, like, life is life goes on.
Yeah.
Like on Saturday morning, my wife and I went out. In fact, we went down to the blood donation center.
Did you give blood?
Well, I didn't give blood. She tried to give blood. The queue was too large. I mean, I know in advance they won't take my blood.
Yeah, because you're English.
Because I'm English.
But I saw some people on TV. And
wait a minute.
Okay.
I mean, my listeners might not know why they won't take. Okay. This is weird as well because, and it's been a very weird time. And like you were telling me about how weird it was for various reasons. But this is weird because in my stand-up comedy routine, I do a bit about how I can't give blood in France because they don't want my blood. You know, they don't want English blood getting into French people's bodies because it affects the brain, you know. and it's all based on like mad cow's disease because we had this outbreak of mad cow's disease in the UK. And so, you know, understandably, the French don't want English blood, you know, because they're worried that it's infected with mad cow. And I don't have mad cow's disease. Well, maybe a little bit, but I'm all right. But anyway, so it's weird. We went down to give blood. My wife went to give blood and there was a huge queue and so we couldn't do it. But, you know, just walking around, just normal, really, a little bit quieter than usual. Mm. But it's pretty much the same thing, you know, everyone's just doing their shopping. You posted a video.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you see my video?
I did, yeah.
For those of you who may not have seen the video, on my Facebook page, I posted a video and in the title, it just said, this is the stuff that you won't see on the news that's happening in Paris right now. And it was just me in the supermarket. I needed to get some food. And in the supermarket, again, there were people in there. It wasn't as busy as usual, but it was still fairly busy. And people were just doing their normal things, you know, selecting wine like they do in the supermarkets here, buying, you know, toiletries, whatever they needed to do. So, yeah, it's a very, I mean, but that's not interesting for the news. You don't, you know, yeah. when you hear there's terrorist attacks in Paris and you turn on BBC World News, you don't want to see people in a supermarket
no.
looking at wine.
All the news shows you is just, you know, these streets with lots of police everywhere and parts of the street have been closed off and there's a monument, you know, in the Place de la République, all the people gathered there. I mean, I did go down there yesterday briefly. Mm. We'll come on to that in a moment. But anyway, the point is that life goes on in Paris, even though there has been this horrible, horrible thing happening. But, you know, life goes on and it should go on because otherwise the terrorists win, don't they? So we're not going to let them, you know, stop us. So we keep laughing, we keep going out, we keep doing the same thing. Basically, we keep calm and carry on, all right? Also, another thing I should say, so, well, that first thing was thank you for your concern, thank you for your messages. Second thing was our thoughts go out to the people who were unfortunately affected by this. And also, a third thing, it's not just Paris, in fact. This is just one of a number of recent ISIS attacks in different places. Recently, two explosions in suicide attacks in a Shiite Muslim district of southern Beirut in Lebanon killed 43 people. And also, 224 people died when a Russian aircraft crashed in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. And that's understood to be ISIS-related as well, I think. Also, apparently, according to Agence France-Presse, which is like the French press agency, Turkey stopped a major Istanbul terror plot on the same day as the Paris attacks. So it's not just Paris. There are things going on everywhere. And it's not just ISIS, of course. There's violence and fighting in many places by many people for many reasons. And of course, it all sucks. And our thoughts go out to anyone who's been the victim of any violence in any country at any time. But in this podcast in particular, we're talking about the attacks in Paris, just because they happened in our town close to home, and we have some direct experience of it, and we just want to tell you about what happened. Paul, in particular, you had some fairly close experience of this. In fact, you are like the most wanted English speaker in town at the moment. All of the different newspapers and TV stations all want to speak to you.
Yeah, it's a little bit weird. Yeah, I lived it close by. I lived it close by. That's not even English, but you know what I mean. I didn't see anything really, but we were like 100 meters away from where one of the restaurants that got shot were.
Yeah.
And
You'll tell us about what happened in a moment, but just to be clear, everyone out there in podcast land who's listening to this, I expect you've seen the story in the news a lot over the last few days. Here in France and in the UK, it's totally dominating the news. Just switch on the TV, this is what's on, of course. But just in case you don't know what happened, let me sum it up for you. And we will go through all the details in a lot more detail in a moment. But in summary, on Friday evening, just a couple of days ago, Paris was attacked by ISIS terrorists. And it's 129 people were killed. It's still 129,
it is, yeah,
isn't
I was just
it?
Checking BBC now, as you're saying.
At the moment, the death toll is 129. 129 people were killed in explosions and shootings. Members of the public were shot in public bars, restaurants and cafes. The worst attack took place inside a live music venue called Bataclan, which is just 100 metres away, about 100 metres away. Is it the Bataclan that's 100 metres away from the Pan Am?
It was one of the bars.
Okay, one of the bars.
But
was...
it's still a 5-10 minute walk away from the Pan Am.
Yeah, okay. So
the
attacks took place close to the Pan Am Art Cafe, where Paul and I often perform comedy shows. And in fact, Paul was there at the Pan Am when the attack happened nearby, or when one of the attacks happened nearby. And so we're going to talk about that and what he saw. So basically, Paul, you know, thank goodness you're all right. I mean, you were quite close to the action. Are you all right? I mean, how do you feel?
I feel all right. I feel fine. That's it. Yeah, I don't feel like I was in any specific danger, really. But it was just a very weird events, basically. It was just strange.
And what have you been doing over the last couple of days then, since the attack happened?
Just the same as everything. We had to take the cat to the vet.
Right.
The cat wasn't feeling very well, and he might have cancer. We're not sure.
Okay.
But it's kind of difficult to feel bad.
Yeah.
About my cat not feeling very well, considering what's happened. So
yeah.
I'm kind of keeping that on the down low, really.
Yeah, because people are like, so hey, how are you, Paul? It's like, well, yeah, I'm feeling pretty bad. Yeah, of course you are. Well, yeah, my cat's got cancer. Never mind all of the other things that have been going on. People keep contacting you. Like Paul earlier, when he arrived at the flat, showed me his phone and he's got all these notifications and emails from different news agencies and things. Mm. Just tell me a little bit about who's been contacting you. Actually, then.
Everyone. What happened was... so if I guess I'll start at the beginning, is when I was about to perform in French.
Okay.
at 9:15 was when the show was starting, and I was performing. I was not the last comedian up, but the second to last comedian up.
Okay.
And just before that show, we had an English speaking show, which was a guy called Ahir who came over from England specifically just to do his 1 hour show. And so he was there as well. And just before I went on stage, I wanted to go find Robert, our friend Robert Hain, who you might have heard on the podcast from a couple of hundred episodes ago, maybe.
Episode 143.
There you go.
A cup of tea with Robert Hain. So he's one of the guys who sort of organises these comedy shows.
Yeah, so I went upstairs to go and speak to him before I went on stage, and he wasn't in the cafe. Mm. So I went outside to see if he was smoking a cigarette. And as I went outside, I saw him and Kareem, the owner of the bar, walking up from... the bottom of the street there,
yeah,
towards us, and he said to me in a normal kind of calm voice, yeah, there's a guy down there with a Kalashnikov shooting people.
Wow.
I thought he was joking, if I'm honest. It's Robert and he's a comedian, so
yeah.
I said, sorry, what? And he goes, yeah, there's something bad happening. And then it was only really when there were two other people that came just behind him, a woman and a guy dressed in lycra, like he was a cyclist.
Right.
The guy was crying.
Yeah.
And I said, so what's that? He thought I was a policeman because I was wearing my comedy shirt and tie.
Paul, when he's on stage, he wears like a white shirt and a black tie. So it looks a bit like a uniform if you're not really concentrating.
Well, the guy thought I was, because I was standing next to Robert, I was speaking in English to Robert, and the guy thought we were part of the police.
Right.
And I said, no, I'm a comedian.
Yeah.
And he laughed, which was like he was crying, but he laughed. He was like, sorry, you're a comedian. I'm like, yeah, we're doing a show downstairs right now.
Mm.
And he told me that he'd seen, you know, just people being shot at the cafe.
Wow.
Like 100 meters away from the Pan Am. And so that's when I knew something like was actually happening. So I tried to look on my phone and go through news. There was nothing on any news.
Well, didn't you feel like a sort of sense of danger? Weren't you running away? Like
no one was running. Even the people that came to us, the guy and this woman, they walked in. They weren't running. They weren't screaming.
They just walked up the road.
They just walked up the road.
They're like, yeah, a couple of people getting shot.
Honestly, that's what it actually felt like. Yeah, and so I went to go find the guy who was hosting the comedy night, another comedian called Lenny.
Yeah.
And I saw him and I said, hey, apparently people have just been shot down the road. And he looked at me and he's like, well, okay.
Really?
But because there was nothing on you, there was no police anywhere yet. There was nothing on the news, obviously, because it had just happened.
I suppose it's that thing about when does something officially become an emergency? Because it doesn't register in your brain that something serious is happening until it seems that everyone has decided it's an emergency. And if you're the only one, it's like, then it's weird how our collective consciousness works, that it doesn't register as a serious event until the majority of people are acting like it's
That's
a serious
exactly
event.
That's exactly what it was, because everyone in the cafe, it was packed, right? The Pan Am, 9:30 on a Friday, absolutely packed. So you know, and but there was a couple of people at the entrance, you know, me included with these people. And you know, when it's like an emergency situation, you know, eyewitness accounts get out of control. You know, people like, I saw 10 dead people, I saw 5 dead. There's no dead people. There's nothing. You know, and it was so everyone was kind of calm. And this guy said, well, I we're not just going to go downstairs, interrupt the show, panic everyone, 80 people in there, when we don't really know what's happened. So we'll just carry on for now and see what happens. So I was like, okay. So I went back downstairs to the basement in the backstage area while one of the other guys called Donald was on stage. Yeah. And he was destroyed. Like, I've never heard any people laugh as loud in that room as with him. He was talking about something with the France football players, like Valbuena, something about a sex tape. The crowd were in hysterics.
But the crowd had no idea what was going on outside.
No one had any idea. So, I knew exactly... Well, I was like, something's happened, and I think people have died. And I texted Addy, and I said, there's been a shooting, I'm fine.
Yeah.
And she was kind of giving me updates by text, so I knew that something serious had happened. And I was preparing to go on stage because I was next up.
Right. So my listeners might be thinking, but how could you carry on as normal when you knew something had happened? But I would say, in your defense, not that I need to defend you, but just to explain, with now, of course, at this position on Monday, we know exactly what happened. We know exactly how serious and how large this thing was. But for you at that moment, you had heard something, it wasn't completely sure what it was, but your mind was probably on trying to make this audience laugh. And since everyone else, all these other people, weren't acting like it was a big deal, it was hard for you to get to take it as seriously as and also you had a pressing engagement. You had to be downstairs on stage to do the show, so it's kind of like you couldn't really process properly, and the same for everyone else. So, you know, so I guess that's how it happened. Yeah,
because we I mean, initially I thought, it's just it's the cafe down the road. That's it. There's nothing else, you know. But we didn't, you know, we figured I don't know. It's just in the thing. It was just like, well, all right, we've got to keep going. And I was laughing at what was happening in there.
Yeah.
But in my mind, I was like, okay, I need to prepare. I need to try and make people laugh, even though I know that people have just been killed down the road. So it was.
But the audience were like laughing really loud.
Oh, outrageously.
And they didn't, so they weren't aware.
No,
But it must have felt pretty crazy though for you, because you were like, it must have felt like quite a hysterical moment in a way, that you knew that in the background something bad was happening, and yet in this room everyone is experiencing such total hysterical joy at the comedy show that's happening.
It was a
weird sort of
closest moment to schizophrenia I think I've experienced, where I was like, okay, I need to make people laugh, but I know that something bad's happened. And so anyway, I got on stage, the guy came off, I went on stage, and I just got my first phrase out, which was, you know, bonsoir Paris, est-ce que ça va bien, you know, hey Paris, how are you? And as soon as that happened, Lenny, the host, came on stage, interrupted the show, and said, no, we've got to stop the show. You know, something bad's happened. And the audience thought it was
part of
the sketch.
Yeah.
Because he started the show and introduced himself and made people laugh, and I was on. So it took about 30 seconds, a minute, for us to be like, no, this is serious. Like, people have been shot down the road, and we need to evacuate. And so The police, by that stage, the police had showed up. This is probably about 10 minutes between me finding out that people had been shot, going downstairs, then going on stage. It was probably about 10 minutes, and then the police had showed up, and they were evacuating us from the Pan Am.
So the police came down into the room?
They didn't come down to the room. The owner came down and interrupted the show.
And how did the audience respond once they realised it was happening? Was there a sense of panic in the room?
A little, not a huge amount of panic, but a little bit, yeah. Like, you know, the a couple of people started like screaming or crying and and things like that. They didn't know what was going on, but it was fairly calm as it was happening. I do have to say that, like, in the future when people ask me, yeah, Paul, what's the worst heckle you've ever had at one of your comedy gigs? And what was, like, how did you respond to it? You know, it's like that. I don't know if there's any worst heckle that you're on stage. A heckle, for those of you who don't know, is when a comedy show's happening and somebody shouts something out to disturb the comedy show. Yeah. And quite often comedians will have something to make fun of the person who shouted out, and then the whole audience are against that person, and it's quite fun.
Yeah, often a heckle would be like, you know, a comment about your appearance or something like, tell us a joke then. You know, or some other bit of abuse from someone in the crowd. And it's like part of stand-up comedy. You have to find a comeback or a way of dealing with a heckle. And comedians always share stories of like their worst heckles. I had a Scouser in the audience one who just kept saying, it's not funny. It's not funny. It's not funny. He seemed so annoyed that my show wasn't funny. Everyone else was laughing, but he apparently didn't want, you know, he wanted to convince everyone else that it wasn't funny. Anyway, that's, here's your worst heckle.
Yeah, my worst heckle is that, and when I tell it on a stage, or I'll change the details. I'll say that armed police came in and but it wasn't that serious. But it was like, yeah, sorry, the show's being interrupted because we need to get evacuated because people are being shot dead, like 100 meters away.
Oh my God.
So. Yeah. That's when I left. I left and I walked home. I walked home down the opposite street. Obviously, the police weren't letting us down the street where the other restaurant was. And so I walked home. And as I was walking home, I was texting my girlfriend, and my mum had called as well.
Yeah.
And the details were still unknown of what had happened, really. So it was the sense of danger wasn't really imminent. You know, people were in the bars and all that kind of stuff in the area, and it was weird because I had information they didn't of what was happening, and as I was talking to my mum on the phone in English, like, I could hear people walking next to me, like, looking at me like, something's happening. So anyway, as I was going home, I sent a tweet to BBC Breaking News to say I was at a live comedy show, it got evacuated because of the shooting.
Because the media, I suppose, didn't know. I mean, you were one of the first people really to know because you were within the vicinity. But before, you know, it spread around the world and around the country on the news, you tweeted the BBC saying something has happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And then they got in touch with me the next day on Saturday morning. And that's kind of where I spent most of all of Saturday and a lot of yesterday talking to journalists from different countries. Which was weird.
And you spoke to the BBC, you spoke to Sky News, didn't you?
Yeah, BBC, Sky News.
Channel 4.
Channel 4. I didn't speak to them, but they got in touch. ITV News in England. A bunch of American radio stations, a lot of Australian radio stations.
Yeah.
Quebec TV stations.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, it was a little bit weird because I hadn't really seen that. I was watching TV and I was seeing like eyewitness accounts of people who were either in the Bataclan or at the restaurant or like actually seeing the stuff. And I, you know, I was close to it, but not really close enough for anything serious to have happened. And but people kept on calling me up all day. And I think Addy wasn't too pleased. But
really, yeah. I imagine people wanted to talk to you because there probably weren't that many sort of English speakers who were eyewitnesses, and also because you're Paul Taylor, you know, they could see on your online profile that you're a comedian, and they probably thought, well, he's probably able to string a sentence together, so he's probably quite true, a good person, who's quite a descriptive person, so that's why they kept calling you, I suppose. Did you find that there was a difference between the style of the communication that you got from different journalists in different countries?
Yeah, it was interesting how the UK news networks, when they sent me emails, they were sending emails saying, you know, hope they started the emails by saying, you know, hope you're safe, hope everything's fine. If you have time for an interview, it would be great, let us know. And the American, I got emails from Fox News and MSNBC in the US, which are pretty big news networks.
Yeah.
And both of theirs just started out really blunt, like, dear Mr. Taylor, can you interview for us in like half an hour? Yeah. I'm like, oh, thanks.
We need to talk to you, Paul.
Yeah.
We
Although, Addy did say to me, they're like, well, they probably heard you on BBC News. Because BBC News were the first people that I spoke to.
Right.
And then, from what I understood, I put my... They transcribed my interview and put it on the BBC News website. Mm. And from that, other news networks, I think, read that. Because everyone that called me afterwards was like, hey, Paul, we heard your interview on the BBC, or we read your interview on the BBC. Would you be willing to talk about the events?
Right.
So, Addy was like, well... To be fair, though, these other news networks, they're probably not asking how you are because they've seen through your Facebook and through your Twitter that you are fine.
Yeah.
And so, but still, it's still.
It would be nice if they just said, sorry for bothering you. Yeah. I hope you're okay. Would you mind giving us an interview rather than, Paul, we need you on Fox News. When are you available? You know, send me an email imminently or something.
Yeah.
But interesting, the first point of contact is probably, you know, normally a little bit more polite. And then after that, a bit more direct.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Interesting.
Very strange.
Some of my listeners told me that they'd either heard you on the news or seen your statements printed on the BBC's website.
Yeah, I saw some of the comments on your website, which was interesting. I got a couple of calls from my family. Like my parents saw me, my grandparents saw me on the BBC.
Yeah.
Because initially it was the breakfast news, like very early. I guess it would have been like 7 a.m. UK time was when I first, was my first interview. And I think they replayed that a couple of times.
Yeah, my parents saw that as well.
Did they?
They're like, oh, Paul Taylor on the news. Yeah. Obviously glad to know that you were okay.
My parents, because they knew I was okay the night before, they were like, oh, we saw you on the BBC News. That's great. Because at the time it was just an audio interview.
Yeah.
Eventually I've only done one video interview. It was Sky News where I was down at the Place de la République. But both my parents... had said to me, oh, you should have plugged your comedy show. You should have talked about the comedy show. And I was like, really, Mum and Dad? That's like me saying, oh, guys, you know, yeah, there was lots of dead people, but don't worry, come and see me and Luke Thompson, 7 p.m. Panama cafes. It's just, you can't do that.
No, that wouldn't really be appropriate, would it?
A couple of people asked me, oh, did you get paid for the interviews? I'm like, are you serious?
No, of course not.
Like a Greek friend of mine, I'm like, a typical Greek, just going straight for the money. Like, did you get paid for the interview? Of course I didn't get paid for the interviews.
All right. Well, so very interesting, Paul. Very interesting to hear your account. And obviously, it just brings it home. It kind of, you know, makes me realize just how bizarre and how horrific this was. That's part of the shock, the transition from normal to emergency. And it's a very weird sort of transition to make, that in just a couple of moments, you go from everything just being a normal evening to people kind of being in mortal danger and being in the knowledge that people have been killed and that you might be in danger, and your mind flashes to all the other people who you know who are in the city, and you think, oh my God, I hope everyone is okay. And suddenly your phone starts to, you know, come to life, and there's just everyone is texting you. And what happened with me is I was out as well. I was at a comedy show.
Yeah, you're at a different one.
I was at the New York Comedy Night, which is in a different part of town, but it's only two metro stations away from Republique. But I wasn't, you know, in the heart of it. But so I was doing a show there as well, and I'd already been on stage, and I was watching the rest of the show, and one of the comedians tapped me on the shoulder, and she said to me, There's attacks are happening in Paris. People are being shot, and there have been explosions. People are, you know, there are shootings all over the city, and it, you know, immediately dawned on me that what was happening, because after January and the Charlie Hebdo attack, it kind of didn't take that long to realize that something similar was going on, you know, because that had happened. So immediately I was like, oh my God, you know, and I rushed to my phone, which was in my jacket, and I quickly checked my text messages. And sure enough, I'd got texts and calls from my mom and from my wife and stuff. So I, you know, texted them and texted my wife to make sure she was okay. She was fine on her way home. And, you know, let my parents know that I was fine as well. Stuck around for the rest of the show because I didn't know.
The show carried on.
Yeah, the show carried on. The audience didn't know what was going on. And I didn't know quite what the situation was outside. And I kind of, you know, went over to the window and had a little peep, you know, looked out of the window to see what was going on in the street. I could see bits of the street, just normal, you know, just normal. It looked like normal life. People were walking up and down, cars in the road and everything. There wasn't any sign that there was something going on outside.
Was there, because at that venue, often we get sirens interrupting the show. Like when you're on stage, the windows, I guess, aren't double glazed. And if a siren goes past, it you can definitely hear it. Were there any sirens in that area or not?
No more than normal.
No?
Okay. I had absolutely no indication that something strange or bad was going on. But again, this was at the time the shootings were going on. And so the police didn't really mobilize. There wasn't like a lot of action from the police until a little bit later, until everyone really knew what was going on. So I didn't notice any sounds of helicopters or sounds of police sirens or anything. It was just a normal evening at the Sojimnas. And, you know, you normally hear a few sirens, as you said. And so, yeah, it didn't strike me as being any different. So I stuck around and watched the rest of the show. And then at the end of the show, Sebastian Marx, our friend who was hosting the night, he did tell the audience, he said, listen, there's been a terrorist attack. There have been shootings in the city. It's going on right now. And the audience didn't believe him.
I'm sure they didn't. Yeah, they didn't believe him. Same with us.
It took, like you said, about 30 seconds to a minute to break the spell of the comedy show. And in fact, one girl in the audience was like, are you kidding? You know, please tell us that you're kidding. And Sebastian was very calm. He handled it really, really well. And he was like, no, I'm not kidding. And he said, I recommend that, you know, you might want to just let people know that you're safe. The bar, you know, we're going to stay open. You can stay here if you want. You know, we're up on the sixth floor and you can stay here. And everyone was quite calm. There was no panic in the room. People immediately got on their mobile phones and everything like that. The show ended as normal. But at that moment, I decided I would go. And I there was a lot of commotion actually in the stairwell, because there's a sort of stairwell, you know, that runs down through the building. And a lot of people were in the stairwell sort of arguing and shouting and sort of a lot of loud conversation going on, which I didn't really understand. But you know, tension was pretty high outside the comedy club in the building. And I decided I would go home at that point. And I checked it out on the map. I found out where the action was happening, and I located it on the map, and I, you know, planned my route home. And my wife, it was a frightening moment, I have to say. I mean, you probably had the same feeling of that kind of like, I've got to get home because things aren't quite safe. But it was a frightening moment because my wife was like, just make sure you walk down quiet streets.
And I
didn't know, for example, really if the shootings were contained or if there might be dangerous people in the street and things like that, and whether there would be action in other places. So I, you know, prepared myself to go home, and I thought, I'll go on foot because it's probably the quickest way. I'm not going to try and take the metro or get a bicycle or anything. I'll just go on foot. And I mean, it was fine. You know, the streets were normal. It was actually quite calm out there, but I, you know, I paced home, and my phone was just, you know, on fire, just people just texting me and stuff like that. And so I was just basically walking and texting at the same time, and just walked all the way home, got into the building. That was a relief, you know, let my parents know I was back. And then, you know, my wife was there, and we just sat on the sofa together and just watched the whole thing unfold on the news.
It must have been even worse for you. Like for me, because it happened just then and we evacuated just as it happened, I had no idea how bad it was.
Right.
We just thought it was the people on the end of our street. So as I was walking home, I wasn't panicked. There was nothing going, because at the time it was like, oh, there's been reports of explosions at Stade de France, which is in the north of Paris. But it was just reports, you know, and it was like, oh, there's reports of maybe like four or five people having been killed. And I was like, oh, okay, that's, it's all, you know, it's all contained. And whereas for you, it was like, I guess it was, it must have been about almost 11 p.m. if the show finished.
Yeah.
So that was like, once all of it had, had happened, but we didn't know still what was happening.
But again, they didn't, I think that, like, for example, the Bataclan was the situation in the music venue, the Bataclan, was ongoing until about 12:30.
Yeah.
So that was still happening at that point. There was still a hostage situation, and four guys or three guys with machine guns in the nightclub. And so, yeah, what I understood as I was leaving the Sceaux Gymnase was there are, you know, there are guys with machine guns on the streets of Paris. And I'd heard things like, you know, AK-47s and hand grenades at Stade de France. Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, I kind of knew, I just, you know, let's be honest, I knew, I'd seen the map, I'd seen the reports, I knew where the stuff was happening. Right. And I thought, reasonably, you know, I think I'm going to be all right if I walk really fast. I don't know. People listening to this might think that was a bit of a risk. But I mean, at the moment, at that time, I think that I knew pretty much that the action was in one place. And so, yeah, I just got home as quickly as possible. But it was a relief to get home, let's say. So what actually happened, I can give you, ladies and gentlemen, a report on specifically what happened on Friday evening. So let me explain it to you. Okay. So, here's the more detailed report. So during the evening of Friday, the 13th of November, that's just a couple of days ago, there were six different attacks in and near Paris. Apparently the attacks were coordinated and carried out by ISIS terrorists. At this moment, the moment that I'm recording this, we have 129 people killed in the attacks, and something like 350 people are injured, with about 100 people still in a critical condition. And critical condition means that they, you know, it's a life and death situation. It's touch and go. So the death toll might rise over the next few days, depending on how people recover in hospital. Let's hope that no more people lose their lives as a result of this. This all happens after some artists working for the Charlie Hebdo magazine were murdered by ISIS terrorists in Paris at the beginning of this year. You know, after that event, there was a big peace march in which hundreds of thousands of people got together to march against terrorism and to celebrate solidarity. And that all happened around the Place de la République area of Paris. And in fact, that area was the focal point of these recent attacks. Here's what happened in the six attacks. And this information is based on what I've read in different articles online, eyewitness accounts, and you know, personal accounts too. So the first thing that happened was Stade de France at 9:20 p.m. So Stade de France is the international football stadium, which is just outside Paris to the north. So a football game between France and Germany was happening in the stadium, and during the game, three explosions were heard from inside the stadium. You can see the footage on TV. The football teams are playing, and there are these three loud bangs outside the stadium. But the game carried on. I mean, people in the stadium didn't know what was happening, because, you know, sometimes you hear fireworks, you know, that's the sort of thing you hear on a Friday night, especially when there's a football match going on. There might be fireworks or different noises. So the game carried on, but the French president, François Hollande, was inside the stadium at the time, and by 9:30 at half time, he had been informed as to what was actually going on, that those bangs had been bombs. And so he was evacuated to the Interior Ministry for an emergency cabinet meeting. And this is while attacks at that moment were actually going on in a number of different places in Paris. It's not until the football game ended that the fans in the stadium really learned what had happened, that three terrorists had set off explosive belts outside the stadium, two at entrances to the stadium and another outside a McDonald's. So, in fact, four people were killed. The three terrorists who'd blown themselves up, and one other person.
They were all at the from what I saw in the French news, the first explosion went off, and the second one didn't go off for about another 10 minutes. So then some of the shootings happened in between some of the explosions.
Okay. All right.
But I'm seeing on the timeline that you've got there that the 9:25.
I think the first explosion went off at 9:20, but then the other explosions at Stade de France maybe happened a little bit later. And in the meantime, the attacks were happening inside Paris. The football fans all gathered on the football pitch, and eventually they were led out of the stadium singing the French national anthem. So the next thing was at 9:25, just a few minutes later, and this was at a place called Le Carillon. Is that how you say that, Paul?
Le Carillon.
Le Carillon bar and restaurant, and another bar right next to Le Carillon, which is called Le Petit Cambodge. Two bars on Rue Alibert, and that was at 9:25 p.m. So these two places are on a road not far from Place de la République, and it's not certain how many gunmen or cars were involved. It could be one shooter and one driver, or two shooters and two drivers, we're not sure. Apparently, what happened is one of the cars stopped outside the two places, just two normal cafes or bars with people sitting inside and outside drinking and eating. One of the cars stopped outside these two places, and a gunman got out, and he started shooting into Le Carillon bar. He just started shooting his machine gun right into the windows of the bar, and then he crossed the street in order to shoot in Le Petit Cambodge. To people nearby, apparently it sounded like fireworks, and people didn't really understand what was going on. Some witnesses say that one of the cars had Belgian number plates, and 15 people were killed and 10 people were injured. I don't know what happened to the shooter and the driver, or shooters and drivers. I imagine that the shooter got back into the car and they escaped. At 9:32, again in another bar nearby, Casa Nostra, Rue de la Fontaine au Roi. This is the one that's near Le Paname, isn't it?
Yeah, it's on the same street. The Paname is the same actual street.
Oh, is that the bar at the bottom of the street?
Yeah, that's as you walk down from the Paname towards République.
Yeah,
you know, there's a Franprix.
Yeah,
supermarket
opposite that.
Just opposite that.
Is it that bar
on the right corner? Yeah, because there's a bar in the right corner. There's also a bar on the left corner.
Yeah,
but it was the one on the right.
I've been to that bar.
Yeah,
it's always busy. It's
crazy, isn't it?
I didn't realise it was that.
Yeah,
place.
That's where it is.
So this one was at 9:32, and apparently a gunman arrived outside Casa Nostra, which is a pizza place and bar, and started shooting at people on the terrace. It's just a place with tables where people sit and drink beer and have conversations. Apparently he was wearing tight black clothing and he had a machine gun. Some witnesses commented that he looked exactly like a trained soldier, standing with one leg in front of the other, firing in short bursts. His clothes very tight-fitting and completely black all over, just like you'd expect from a combat soldier. He appeared calm. He didn't say anything. And after shooting a number of people on the terrace, he swiveled. That means he sort of turned mechanically, like the way trained soldiers do. And he shot through the window of a car, presumably killing the people in the car or the driver. And then he went into the cafe. More shots were fired. And then when the police arrived, they couldn't find the gunman. Five people were killed and eight people were injured there. Just a couple of minutes later, at 9:36 p.m., in a place called Restaurant La Belle Équipe, which is on Rue de Charonne, again nearby, this is where the next thing happened. And this is a popular restaurant on a street corner in a cool part of Paris where people like to eat out, drink on the terrace outside the restaurant, and generally just enjoy life like they do here in Paris on a Friday evening. The restaurant was fully booked on Friday evening with quite a lot of seats outside. And so at 9:36, according to witnesses, a car pulled up outside the restaurant and a man got out with a high caliber weapon, like an assault rifle or a machine gun or something like that. And he then quite calmly began shooting at people sitting outside La Belle Équipe. Within a few seconds, everyone was on the floor, either dead or just protecting themselves. Witnesses said that people were screaming and moaning. 3 minutes later, the gunman got back in the car and they drove away. 19 people died there. And then at 9:40 p.m. At the Bataclan, this is this is the Bataclan is a concert venue in the 11th arrondissement of Paris, again not far from where all the other attacks happened, and it's a place where people go and see live music. And on Friday, about 1,500 people were in the venue listening to a Californian rock band. At 9:40, three men started shooting AK-47s randomly into the crowd. Apparently, these guys had just entered the club. I don't know how they managed to get in with guns. Maybe they shot their way into the room. I don't know. But anyway, apparently these guys appeared in the club, which was full of people, and they just started randomly shooting into the crowd. And I can't imagine what that would be like. I've seen some you know, shaky camera footage of what happened. You see the band playing on stage, and suddenly you hear this loud banging. And the guitarist, you know, stops playing and he can hardly believe what he's seeing. The drummer, you know, drops down behind the drum kit. Apparently, these men were no more than 25 years old, dressed all in black. And apparently, they were calm and silent as they fired their weapons into the crowd, killing a lot of members of the audience. Apparently, everyone hit the floor, lying on top of each other, protecting each other, trying to avoid getting shot. The gunman walked around, reloading and continuing to shoot people as they lay on the floor. A lot of people managed to escape from the building, some of them getting shot in the process, and there is some video footage of people scrambling out of the back of the venue, some people even hanging from outside the windows, doing whatever they can to escape the shooting. The terrorists held about 20 people hostage inside the club. According to a witness called Pierre Yanasak, who hid in the toilet but could hear what was going on, the terrorists were talking to the hostages, saying stuff like, "It's the fault of Hollande, it's the fault of your president, he should not have intervened in Syria." Apparently, people who were stuck inside the Bataclan were using social networks to communicate with the outside world, with messages like this one. Someone wrote, "I'm heavily wounded. Please, police, you have to launch an assault. There are people alive here, but they're killing them one by one." This all went on for several hours. The police were on the scene, but they couldn't get inside. Special forces arrived at about 12:20 and raided the building because it was clear that the gunmen were still killing hostages on the inside. Within a couple of minutes, the three terrorists were dead and it was over. Two of them had blown themselves up with explosive belts they were wearing, and one of them was shot. The scene inside the Bataclan has been described as a bloodbath. Immediately after the attack, about 90 people were dead. And now there is a memorial outside the venue with flowers, messages and candles. And the final attack happened near the Bataclan on Boulevard Voltaire. At 9:40, and this restaurant is on a road which connects Place de la République with Place de la Nation, two big intersections and meeting places. And Boulevard Voltaire is the road where some world leaders marched for peace after the Charlie Hebdo attacks earlier this year. You might have seen all those leaders like François Hollande and David Cameron and Angela Merkel walking arm in arm. This is the road where this last attack happened. And apparently one of the attackers involved in the Bataclan incident, a fourth attacker, ended up here. I guess he was the fourth one. He went into the restaurant, apparently ordered a coffee, and then blew himself up. The attacker is dead, and one person is seriously injured as a result of that one. So that's what happened in the six attacks.
You know what? As you were talking about some of that stuff, I was reading. So there's two things that come to mind here. First of all, most of the deaths came from the shootings, even though four people, all but one, by the sounds of it, blew themselves up. This last one you mentioned killed one person by blowing himself up. The people at the stadium blew themselves up, but there was only one person that died at the stadium. It seems like everyone else was shot. The second thing that's interesting, and this is only because I'm reading the BBC news here, so it seems like there's two cars, right? There's a black Seat and a black Volkswagen Polo.
Okay.
Now, apparently the Seat is the one that hit up the restaurants. So the three restaurants there, the three restaurants. There was
Boulevard Voltaire, but the guy was not in a car. He came from the Bataclan, went in and blew himself up in the cafe.
Okay.
So there's the, as well as the Bataclan and Boulevard Voltaire, there is La Belle Equipe, one restaurant, Casa Nostra, another restaurant, and then the Carillon and Le Petit Cambodge. So three bars.
Yeah, all of those were reportedly the SEAT drove. That was the SEAT car that drove up to those restaurants.
Right.
But the one that went to the Bataclan was the black Volkswagen Polo.
Okay.
So something's weird. Because I don't like, so the people that went to the Bataclan, those three are dead.
Yeah.
Who were in the Volkswagen Polo, but we've not heard about the SEAT and the people that were the attackers that were in the SEAT, unless they changed cars or something. But it's what I find strange is just in the media, as I said to you earlier on, like when this was happening throughout the night, and at the end of the night at about 2 a.m.,
yeah,
when they finally had the assault, and they it was like the danger's over. That was the main message: is the danger's over,
right?
But I don't know how they know that they've managed to kill everyone.
Yeah, there are some weird things, like some gaps in the news. But I mean, okay, first of all, I suppose the media, it's difficult for them to cover the story, and you know there are going to be missing bits of information because they don't know, and they're trying their best to try and report the story, I suppose. So, you know, like missing bits of information could be interpreted as just the journalists trying to cover the story. You know, obviously some people are going to interpret missing bits of information as some sort of conspiracy or something like that, but I don't believe in that.
No, it's not even that. It's just what I'm worrying about is that, like,
how many people are still out there?
If there's still people out there, why are they not telling us?
Right.
And why is, and because I think if there were still people out there and they said there's still people, like three of the gunmen haven't, the people who were in this black SEAT, the guys who shot the people in the restaurants, we don't know where they are. Then it's kind of like, well, all right, there's still... the impression that I'm getting from the news is it's kind of all right. They're looking into certain things. They're looking for one guy in particular, all this kind of stuff. But I don't know, that just hit me now.
Well,
I was reading this.
There are, I mean, various people are saying that there's still a big threat, that attacks could happen again at any time. I suppose if those were coordinated attacks, seems that those attacks of that coordinated series of attacks has been done, and if something else happens, it could either be a random thing of like someone, one of these guys who's still on the run and is defending himself, or maybe there could be we don't know what the level
maybe
of threat is.
Maybe there was just one guy in the black SEAT and that's the guy they're looking for.
Maybe, but let's track it. Let's try and work it out. So the news was saying that there were eight terrorists, right? The number eight was being bandied around, and seven of them were killed. Seven out of the eight were killed, and there was one left. But surely it's more than eight, isn't it?
But it says eight, and then it says three coordinated teams.
So three coordinate... Well, the problem here is that eight doesn't divide into three very easily.
Well, it was the stadium was one of them.
The stadium had three guys.
The SEAT car was the second team, and the Volkswagen car was the third team. I think that's what they're referring to.
Okay, yeah. Stade de France, Bataclan, which is the Volkswagen, and then the SEAT, which seemed to drive between these restaurants. All right. But if it is eight people, it doesn't make sense, does it? Because you've got three people at Stade de France. They all killed themselves. So that's three. Three guys at the Bataclan who killed themselves, and one of them was shot. So that's six. The guy who left the Bataclan and went to Boulevard Voltaire and ordered a coffee and then blew himself up, that's seven. Yeah. And then that means that there's only one guy who was in a SEAT driving around shooting up the restaurants. But apparently some witnesses said that there was a driver, that there was a guy in the SEAT. Like, it would be difficult, wouldn't it, to do it all on your own.
Potentially,
especially if and the news are saying that it's a team, so it's a bit weird. So it seems like there are more people. And of course, it won't just be these guys. There'll be some sort of leader who coordinated these attacks, some kind of mastermind who's in charge of this stuff. It won't just be eight people. Because I reckon the way these things work is that the leaders don't do the dirty work, and they're not the ones who kill themselves at the end. The leaders are the ones who persuade other young, impressionable soldiers to do this kind of suicide attack. and it's the leaders who mastermind it. So yeah, I'm sure this, there's a problem. This must be a network of people who are involved.
It still doesn't make sense, though. This is again from the BBC. The attackers appear to have worked in three coordinated teams using the same type of assault whatever. So three attackers blew themselves up outside Stade de France. That's what we just talked about. One died after detonating his bombs at the Comptoir Voltaire.
Yeah, four.
Four. Three men wearing vests inside...
The Bataclan.
The Bataclan.
That's seven.
That's seven. So they're saying seven, and they're saying this one guy, they're looking for this one guy who's been described as a key suspect. That still doesn't explain the fact that there were two different cars.
Well, I suppose the two different cars is that the four guys went to do the Bataclan in a Volkswagen, and they left the Volkswagen outside.
Yeah.
And they all died, okay? One in Boulevard Voltaire and the three inside the Bataclan, all right?
What was the car that they found yesterday outside of Paris?
That is the Seat. They found the Seat discarded somewhere.
In Montreuil,
and it was full of weapons as well.
So there's someone still on the loose, is what the thing is.
It's at least one guy, and it's this guy who was dressed in tight black clothing who shot up all of the bars and restaurants near Le Paname. That's the guy who's still out there. But there must be more than just him, because I'm sure that there are other people who were involved in the planning of this
stuff. Of course,
yeah. The leaders who don't want to blow themselves up, the ones who are happy to convince other people to do suicide missions, but they won't do it themselves.
Potentially,
these guys must be out there,
or they've done it of their own accord, and ISIS are just taking responsibility for it. You know, because in all honesty, I was talking about this yesterday with Addy. Like it wouldn't have taken a huge. The only planning really that would have needed to happen is how do we buy the guns and get the explosives, because apart from that, apparently I read on one of the French website that one of the guys actually had a ticket into the match, and he got rejected by security guards.
They picked up the electronic door or the magnetic door sensor, picked up on the fact that he had the explosives, and then quite quickly after he was rejected, he blew himself up.
So, I mean, I guess the planning was we need to buy tickets to go to the match.
Yeah.
We need to find the weapons and we need to get the explosives and rent the cars.
And then just decide what time this is all going to happen.
Yeah, because all they had to do after was just drive around town and do it. So it's not like a, you know, 9/11, which was clearly a lot more planning because you need to have pilots. Get some guns and go and shoot. Like, so if we had guns in this house right now, it wouldn't take a lot of planning for us to go and kill a lot of people. Yeah.
And I'm sure it's possible to get guns on the black market. It won't be difficult. So what you're saying is this a centralized ISIS attack organized from their headquarters in Syria, or was this just some local disillusioned local guys who did it in the name of ISIS, and now ISIS are taking responsibility for it?
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a good point.
There's a connection with Belgium.
I personally think that it's a coordinated attack from HQ, from ISIS HQ in Syria. And the reasons I say that is not because of the way it was coordinated, because as you say, it wasn't that complicated a plan. You know, any Tom, Dick or Harry could have come up with that plan. But it's the fact that these guys seem to be military soldiers. They seem to have military experience. The eyewitness accounts of the guy who shot up the restaurants and the people in the Bataclan suggested that they were very calm. And composed, and the way that they fired and held their weapons suggested military training. And if these are guys who just come from, you know, the badlands of the Paris suburbs or areas of Belgium or whatever, then how did they train to use weapons in this way? Yeah. So I'm sure I expect that these are guys who may be French or Belgian citizens who went to Syria and Iraq to work with ISIS, and they were trained there, and they had combat experience there, and they learnt how to fire weapons. These are young, impressionable guys who, for one reason or another, are disillusioned with the culture that they live in Europe, and they associate with the ISIS movement, and that they've actually been there, had training, and then been further indoctrinated and sent back as agents of ISIS, maybe given a plan, or maybe at least given the motivation to form their own plan, and then they've done this. But I think it's an ISIS.
Yeah, probably.
I think it's related to their headquarters.
Whatever it is, it's crazy. It's weird because it's shocking, but I'm not surprised.
Well,
I'm actually more surprised it hasn't happened earlier or on a bigger scale than you know anywhere else. Because I mean, you know how tricky is it to get to wear an explosive vest? Obviously, if you've got metal detectors outside of the stadium, that obviously is great.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, after the Charlie Hebdo things happened that same weekend, I think it happened on a Thursday maybe, and that same weekend there were like 3.7 million people in Paris marching.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It was millions of people with all the heads of state all in like one row walking down.
Yeah.
And I honestly thought I was there. I was like, how difficult would it be to just if you're in an apartment block, you know, above where they were marching, how difficult would it be to throw a grenade down there and kill all of them in one go? But that didn't happen. It's probably because the intelligence agencies, there's a lot of stuff they don't tell us, obviously.
I'm sure that the intelligence agencies, even though this happened, which some people are saying is an indictment of the intelligence agencies who didn't prevent it.
Mm.
You know, people are saying, how did this happen? You know, is this the fault of the French intelligence or agencies or whoever is responsible for stopping these things?
Yeah.
I'm sure that actually they are working pretty hard to monitor the sorts of people who would do this kind of thing. It's probably hard for them to keep track of everyone, especially if they're dealing with the intelligence services of ISIS, who aren't, I mean, like, you know, people are calling them idiots. They are idiots because they're wrong, of course, but I'm sure that they've got some military sort of acumen. They've got some military sense, and it may be possible for them to send agents back into Europe under the radar, you know, avoiding,
yeah.
You know, these guys may have been like proper sleeper style intelligence guys. I mean, what I'm saying is that their whole lives were probably devoted to doing this to the extent that they never went out. Like, their existence was just never mentioned.
Yeah. Well, a couple of them have been on, like the guy who they've named was already on a list of.
Oh, that's right. He was a petty criminal. Yeah.
But I mean, at the same time, like, I think there's so many things. I think they stop this happening probably on a regular basis, and we have no idea that they're stopping. Because if they told everyone, can you imagine if they came on the news and were like, oh, today another foiled terrorist plot? Like, we'd all be crapping ourselves all the time. We'd all be so worried, and we'd all be sitting indoors. And you know, it's probably it probably happens on a regular basis that they managed to stop it, and this was just unfortunately the time that for some reason they weren't able to stop it.
Yeah.
But it's yeah, as I said, I'm not surprised it happened, and I'm surprised that it hasn't happened before. Like in another major, like Western city, you know, there's a lot of stuff on Facebook and a lot of people saying, well, why is all the attention on Paris when Beirut got bombed,
right,
and you know, other people got bombed and things like this? And I think it's because it's, you know, it's a major Western city it's the most visited city in the world by tourists, and I think that's why it's got all the media attention.
Right.
Whereas kind of in Lebanon, it's almost expected in a sad way.
It's very sad
that you know, people are dying all over the world in explosions and suicide bombings, but it's the media don't cover it as much because it happens on such a regular basis it's kind of like, I stopped watching the news because of that, like about 5 years ago, where it's just every day it's like, you know, suicide bombing in Baghdad or suicide bombing in some other country.
You get desensitized.
Yeah, absolutely.
You get desensitized to it eventually. There's so much more to talk about. Like, for example, you know, ISIS, like who are they? And what do they actually want? And what do they expect to get from this? And also things like, how did they organize an attack on Paris? And also things like, you know, what was the ISIS statement? Because they did issue a statement, which has been translated into English. And, you know, why did they do it? And also, what's going to happen next? What are the implications of this? What's the bigger picture? So much more to say. I mean, you know, I think we know who ISIS are. right? I mean,
bunch of wankers.
Bunch of wankers. Yeah, and like, so they are. They have claimed responsibility for this. Okay, let's do a really quick who are ISIS. All right, basic who are ISIS. So they ISIS, ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, sometimes known as ISIL, which is the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or IS, which is the Islamic State, or in France they call them Daesh.
Yeah, Daesh. What does that stand for?
I think it's Arabic, or I think, again, it's an acronym, which basically means the Islamic State, I think, but I'm not sure. That's Daesh is the word that they use in French anyway. So it's an offshoot of Al-Qaeda originally in Iraq. And basically, ISIS have established a caliphate, and that is an area ruled by one leader. And they've in that area that they've taken, which is kind of northern Iraq and parts of Syria, they've established a caliphate, and they've imposed their harsh interpretation of Islamic law there. It's a kind of very super strict conservative Islamic law which applies in the caliphate. Now, there's a lot of stuff going around about religion. People will be using this story as a way to bash Islam. Well, of course, you know what, there's something like 1.6 billion Muslims in the world, and the vast majority of them are peaceful. Obviously these guys don't represent the majority of Muslims out there. Of course not. These guys are, it's like some sort of twisted version of the Islamic doctrine. Why it is they believe this kind of stuff, I'm not sure, but I mean, I would say probably they're like the children and the children of the children of war, that they come out of a world that's been dominated by conflict, and that they've misunderstood or misinterpreted the doctrine. It's difficult to know what came first, their doctrine or their hatred, or is the doctrine twisted by their hatred? It's really difficult to know. What I mean, obviously they're wrong. I mean, that's the thing, they're completely wrong. And you know, you see in their statement things like they describe Paris as the capital of prostitution and obscenity, which I don't even think that, I mean, if prostitution was their problem, why are they having a go at a nightclub? Like, they described the concert as a prostitution party.
Right.
Sorry, guys.
Have they been to Holland?
Well, yeah, exactly.
Surely they're the capital of prostitution.
And there isn't a capital of prostitution anyway. But, like, first of all, okay, you attack the nightclub because it's a prostitution party. Well, sorry, it wasn't a prostitution party.
Nightclub being what? The concert?
The concert.
Okay.
It was just live music. Like, for these guys, music, you know that they've banned music. Music is sinful.
Where? For ISIS?
For ISIS.
Really?
Yeah, music is sinful. I mean, you know, we could go into their ideology, but I think we all agree that it's bullshit, right? I mean, you know, everyone agrees, including most Muslims. You know, everyone understands that this is just some twisted ideology. And they hate the way of life in Paris. They hate what our lifestyle symbolizes. They see our life as obscene. Paris, for them, is the capital of obscenity and prostitution, which is obviously not accurate. I mean, if they wanted to have a go at prostitution, they should have gone to, what's that place in Paris? There's an area where all the prostitutes hang out.
Pigalle.
No, not a Pigalle. Well, they could have had a go at Pigalle.
Bois de Boulogne. Bois de Boulogne, yeah.
It's like a park on the outskirts of Paris, yeah, where all the prostitutes are, apparently. Why didn't they go to Bois de Boulogne anyway? But the reasons why they've done it is obviously they hate our ideology, and they see France as like an embodiment of everything they hate about sort of Western democratic ideology and stuff. And they see it as obscene. It's not really. Mm. It's not that bad.
I think it's more less to do that more with the fact that France have got some stuff in Syria going on.
Well, yeah, I was going to come on to that. There's also the sense that France is known for being intolerant of Islam.
Yeah,
and the foreign policy at the moment, that France has been launching attacks in Iraq and Syria against ISIS targets, and actually, I think a lot of these the attacks on Friday are basically acts of revenge against those attacks by France. So yeah, we're in a war basically, and François Hollande, the president of France, said it himself: we're now in a war. Great, we're in a war. Fantastic. How High did five. That happen? How the hell did we end up in a war? No one likes war. So that's annoying, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they bombed them last night, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right. As the French have retaliated, and apparently last night they launched a large bombing campaign with something like 10 planes sending 20 bombs on Raqqa, which is in Syria. That's where the headquarters of ISIS is. And according to the news, they've targeted guns and munitions, and the second target was a terrorist training camp. I heard one report that no people were killed.
Yeah.
I don't believe that.
That's what they're saying now, is that ISIS, really? ISIS are claiming that the French hit empty stuff, which is maybe them covering for the fact that we managed to kill some of them.
Maybe ISIS are saying, no, you didn't get anyone, which, you know, obviously they would say that in order to sort of take away the victory. But who knows, really? That's the other thing, isn't it, Paul, about this kind of thing? Ordinary people like us, we don't really know. We're just speculating.
We haven't got a clue.
Just trying to work out what's going on. And it's really hard. It ends up just being speculation. And that's not a very healthy situation, because it breeds things like conspiracy theories and stuff like that. And I guess it's just a question of trust. We just have to trust our leaders and hope that they're doing the right thing. But of course, there is an argument that says if you wage war abroad, then it's going to come back to you. That's what some people argue, that this has happened precisely because France and other Western nations have been aggressive in other areas, and it's just coming back to us. What goes around comes around.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But what's going to happen next?
How is he released without charges? So the brother of one of the attackers at the Bataclan is released without charges.
This is breaking news on the BBC. Yeah. So the brother of one of the Bataclan attackers has been released without charges. Well, I guess they've got nothing. They've got no evidence to prosecute him with, I suppose. And if they've got no evidence, then they can't hold on to him, because otherwise it's illegal.
Well, they said that apparently they can hold him on for 4 days because it's the state of emergency. That's the rules, apparently. Right. But I guess he's not in France. Is he in Belgium? Police, I don't know. Whatever. It's ridiculous. If you're,
Well, I mean, we can't say much more because we're just speculating, and we're not like experts on the situation. And I expect that if you just switch on the news, you're likely
you'll
to get
more better news than from us.
Yeah, but apparently there, the authorities are warning us that more attacks will happen, and probably not just in Paris, but anywhere. It could be, London, could be anywhere else. Security is probably going to be stepped up now. Apparently France has closed its borders. It's going to be harder for us to live our lives freely. It may be harder to travel between countries. I expect that certain right-wing politicians are going to point at immigration and say we this is a reason why we can't let Syrian refugees into our country, which is, I don't know if that's really fair, because think about the thousands of immigrants. And the reason these people are escaping from Syria is the same thing. I mean, they're running away from ISIS.
Yeah.
So they're not ISIS. They're running away from ISIS. Of course, there may be a couple of people in those groups of refugees, hiding amongst those refugees that may be sort of terrorists themselves. But it seems that if ISIS terrorists want to travel into Europe, they can. They don't need to do it under the protection of, or they don't need to disguise themselves as refugees. It seems that they can travel here if they want to travel here. So I think the refugee crisis and the ISIS situation are actually separate issues, but I think probably right-wing politicians will say that they're the same issue, and that this will be a reason for them to close the borders and get the immigrants out, and it'll be used as an excuse to clamp down on immigration. That's it then, isn't it? That's it.
So it's full out war. Let's just do it. Get it over and done with.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well,
it's crazy.
I don't know. I don't know. But anyway, looking out the window, sort of pretty normal out there, really. It's a grey day. There's the Eiffel Tower. Just normal life.
Yeah. Yeah, for now.
Yeah.
Until something else happens.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Luke's English podcast will continue as normal. I've got some new episodes to publish.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
I'm excited. I'm supposed to get back on stage this evening.
Oh, are you?
I was supposed to get back on stage on Saturday, but the show got cancelled, and I was supposed to get back on stage yesterday. Show got cancelled.
Oh, yeah.
So hopefully today the show won't get cancelled, and we'll get back to laughing.
Friend of ours is planning a birthday party next weekend. She was planning to do it in a bar near where all this stuff happened. We're trying to convince her to move it somewhere else.
Is she just not wanting to do it, or is she...
No, she wants to do the party.
Oh, she still wants
to do it.
It's
her 30th party.
Oh.
She wants to do it, but, you know, we're all trying to say to her, can you move it somewhere else? Just feels a bit dodgy to do it there.
Then you've got that theory of, well, are they going to attack the same place again, or would they just attack a different part of Paris if they were going to attack Paris
It seems
again?
That's the place that they focused on for whatever reason. Mm. I mean, you know, they seem to focus on groups of young people. I mean, that part of Paris is full of young sort of hipsters who like to... It's just a cool place where young people like to go out. I mean, we go out there sometimes. It's a really good spot.
Yeah.
So for some reason, these guys seem to have that as a target. But also, I don't know. You never know. You don't know where they're going to go next. But, you know, we're not going to cancel the party.
No, that would be stupid.
It's a party, isn't it? So we're not going to cancel the party. We're just, you know, going to move it somewhere that might be a little bit safer.
Move it to London.
Well, do you think London's going to be safer?
No, probably not.
I don't know. I don't know where... It doesn't matter. We're still going to have a party. We just need to be a bit more careful. All right, then. Good. What are you doing for the rest of the day?
I don't know. Maybe talking to news people again.
Do you want to have lunch with me?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's have our croque monsieur or croque madame and a beer like we normally do.
Croque madame is... My listeners might not know that, but it's like a great French... lunch.
Look it up on Google. If you type croque madame, croque, next word madame, like madame, you'll see a nice picture of it, and it's a lovely toasted cheese ham sandwich with an egg on top.
Yeah, lovely, and a bit of salad on the side. And why not? Let's have a beer. Come on,
let's do it.
Let's celebrate
that we're still alive.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, listeners, thanks very much for listening to this episode. I hope that. I don't know. I just hope that you, I hope that you're all right there, wherever you are. And thanks again for your messages of concern recently. But Luke's English Podcast is, you know, carrying on as normal. And as I said, I've got some new episodes to upload. These are episodes which we recorded a while ago, like a week or two ago, that I've edited. So they'll go up in the next few days, and it'll just be business as usual. Okay. So thanks very much. That's it. Speak to you again soon. But for now, it's time to just say
bye.
Goodbye. Bye.
Au revoir.
Bye.
Au revoir. Au revoir. Au revoir. Au revoir.
Hello, it's Luke again. I haven't finished. In fact, I just wanted to add something at the end of this episode. And I'm just going to sort of read something as a final thought. This is from the British Humanist Association on their website, humanism.org.uk. And this was published on their website today, and I think that this is quite a nice way to end the episode, so I'm just going to read this post from the British Humanist Association. I'll turn off the noises on my phone so that we don't get disturbed. So it goes like this. On the tragic events in Paris, an attack on freedom and human dignity, from humanism.org.uk on November the 16th, that's today, 2015. We live in an uncertain, fragile world. And yet in this world, there is joy. We find a way through the hardships of life, the pains, the tribulations, the daily struggles, to make life mean something more. We socialize. We enjoy the pleasures of music or a good book. We watch films. We play sports. We enjoy a drink or a meal. We find joy and happiness in life itself. And we can do so freely, whatever our tastes may be, so long as we do not harm others. In a city like Paris, all interests are catered for. It's a city characterized not so much by its politics, architecture, or history, as it is by life itself, by joy, by the bustle of humanity, by the diverse preferences and tastes of millions living side by side. And yet life itself, the joy of living, was the target of Islamic extremists with a burning hatred for these very freedoms on Friday night, killing well over 100 people. They didn't attack infrastructure, politicians, military personnel, or sites of historical or cultural significance. They targeted innocent people going about their lives, trying to make it through this difficult and complicated world with a modicum of fun and lightness, something we all aspire to. It was, in every sense, an attack on multiculturalism, an attack on how we find happiness outside the confines of a strict religious code of submission, an attack on the secular, enlightened spirit embodied by Paris's vibrant, varied culture. Our hearts go out to all those affected over the world, and not just by events in Paris, but by those in Beirut and Syria and everywhere the cruel hand of extremism is felt. Today, we make one request of you, and it's a simple one. Enjoy your life. Make it count, and don't let the murderers win. Our dream is of a tolerant, open society with a secular state ensuring the human rights of everyone, where we can all go about the living, where we can all go about living the kinds of lives we want for ourselves. That dream, that essential humanist cause, is now more important than ever. I just wanted to read that at the end, just as a final thought. And so, once again, it's just time for me to say goodbye. So I'm going to do it now. Not for the last time, of course. Oh, no. There'll be more episodes of Luke's English Podcast coming in your direction soon. Okay, but for now, goodbye. Bye, bye, bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.